I ain't a snack guy.
No, never. You have no secret guilty pleasures or non-guilty pleasures.
What about healthy?
I don't do snacks.
How about this? Would you consider picking a snack for us to eat?
You're the curator.
You go, yeah, you can curate the snack.
My head ain't really wrapped around the snack.
Well, maybe after the at the hour bark, maybe you'll feel more enthused about it.
No, I won't.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your mad ultrasonic esophagus of weekly culture chat. I'm John Caramonica, and I'm the critic.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, and I'm the reporter.
And I'm Busta Rhymes, and you are on Popcast.
Sure. We are all on Popcast.
Everybody in this room is on Popcast. Everybody out there, kind of on Popcast, too.
Busta Rhymes is here. Busta Rhymes has been a game-changing rapper for 35 years from Leaders of the New School and a breakout verse on A Tribe Called Quest scenario in the early 1990s. Rawr, rawr, like a dungeon dragon. To Hoo Ha, Got You All in Check. When I step up in the place, say yo, I step correct. Hoo Ha, all in check. Huge features, Don't Ya by the Pussycat Dolls. Well, let me get straight to it, Abe Broad won't watch it. When I come Look at Me Now, one of the most rapped verses of the new millennium. Cause I'm feeling like I'm running and I'm feeling like I gotta get away.
Better know that I don't and I won't ever stop cause you know I gotta win every day. Maybe the most consequential guest rapper in hip hop history.
He's back with a new album coming out that's Diligence 2 on all J Dilla beats, the late Detroit producer. Sequel to a 2007 mixtape.
Welcome to the show. We're happy to have you. You're here on a very specific occasion.
I think we should just jump right in with the new music. You just dropped a new single, Spaz.
Quite literally on the couch.
Yeah, you literally just said, we have to pause 1 second. We can't start because I have to post my new song. Enjoy the best show. Y'all don't want me Spaz, my nigga. How you want it? Talk to us a little bit about the relationship that you had with Dilla while he was alive. He passed away 2006, complications from lupus. This is somebody you came up with in hip hop alongside many other collaborators. Talk about the relationship you guys had in real time and then what it's like to return to that music 3 decades later.
I didn't get the music 3 decades later. It kind of came periodically throughout the relationship from when we first worked together on the Coming album, which was 30 years ago this year. In my experience with Dilla, he was a man of few words. You know what I'm saying? I heard him talk more when he was rhyming than in actual regular conversation.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? A lot of the times when I was around Dilla, you know, after we have our initial greet, give each other dap, smoke a little spliff together, he's immediately getting to the work. Mm. And you pretty much just sit around and vibe and just watch the process. And Dilla definitely was a man of humor. Like he loved to laugh and smile and just be in a feel good energy space. But he definitely was deeply entrenched in wanting to live in the creative space constantly. But he front loaded me so much music throughout the years. He was really always looking forward to what the result of what I was going to do to the music he gave me would turn out to be.
Yeah.
He would just shoot me shit constantly, and knowing that I was super duper drawn to his production style and the pockets that his music would land in.
Yeah.
And it would make me feel inspired to always want to challenge myself to marry his music in a way that just felt as close to perfect as possible.
Talk to me about the rhythms of a J Dilla beat, because you, of course, known for extremely acrobatic speed rapping, finding these pockets you're talking about. Dilla is known for being off kilter, right? This idea of Dilla time, right? There's a big book that came out by Dan Charnas a couple of years ago, breaking down the musicology of what makes a Dilla beat have that sort of drunken, uneven quality. What does that do to you as a rapper? What are you hearing in that allows you to attack these songs in different ways?
I mean, for me, I'm more feeling than hearing. Sonically, I don't think there's ever really like a beat, even if it's not something that I would want to rhyme on that I thought was, or I felt like I didn't like how it sounded. I think the most interesting part about it was he mastered the understanding of knowing that the soulfulness of music comes from human timing.
Yeah.
You know?
You want to feel the texture of the hand on it.
Human timing is never perfectly on time all the time. Quantizing timing from a computer is a 1, 2, 3, 4. Any human timing is never always perfectly on time in the same pattern of timing through the whole song. So the human timing, it adds a feeling because it's coming from a soul. So Dilla, I just feel like he mastered that in a way that was unlike anybody else. He's not the only producer that does it, you know what I'm saying? But he's the only producer that makes me feel what I feel from when he does it.
What does it bring out in you as a rapper? Because I'm sure you've rapped on hundreds of quantized beats that are perfectly metronomic, right?
I don't think it's words that can explain it. I think it's feeling that it brings out. So you feel what you feel from Busta Rhymes when I'm rhyming on Dilla. That might be a little different from what it is when I'm rhyming on everything else, even if it's not quantized. Because even with Questlove, when he plays drums, and I think, you know, we get that feel from our late, great, beloved brother, D'Angelo's music.
Who is featured on this album with you?
I ain't disclosing none of these things yet.
Okay. All right.
Dilla worked closely with D'Angelo, too, with Quest, when he was doing Soul Quarians.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And I think that feeling is what also contributed to what made D'Angelo's work so incredible, too, because he understood the art and the mastering of that feel. If you notice, I've never tried to speed rap on a Dilla beat.
Mm.
It doesn't warrant that.
Yeah.
It doesn't give me that feeling to want to do that, or even I don't even think in that way when I listen to his music.
Sure.
What's the state of the speed rapping these days? Do people still respect being able to flow quickly in the way that you're renowned for? Do you see that as a lineage and a legacy that is ongoing? Or is it out of time, out of date?
I don't think that anything is out of style or out of date if you do the shit in an amazing way that motherfuckers can't front or refuse. I never speed rapped because I wanted to rap fast. I loved the way that the rhythm pattern of what I was doing worked with the beat, because I played drums. My father got me my first drum set, six-piece Remo drum set, when I was like 7 years old. So I'm into drums and I'm into rhythm, and I produce and I make beats myself. A lot of my flow patterns come from the perspective of looking at how am I going to add to this track or this production as an instrument. Like, I'm playing dodgeball with the carrot kicking the snare, and I could fit this amount of words between the kick and the snare in that little dead space. But you don't hear me say a word on the kick or the snare, and in between the other kick and snare after, how do I fit another 3-4 words in that bitch? But if I got to say it quickly to make it fit, it's more about that than it is about speed rapping. You know what I'm saying? So I don't speed rap because I thought it was cool at the time. I speed rap because it felt right for the song.
You've said over the years that you were sitting on some 300 unreleased
almost
beats,
300.
Nearly 300 beats.
Yeah.
How did you boil that down to what's ending up on this Diligence 2 album?
What felt right. That's really what it boils down to. I don't overthink the music no more. I think a lot of the times when you overthink the shit, it ends up never coming out. You know what I'm saying? I don't enjoy sitting on shit that feels right.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did the Big Bang album and when I did Extinction Level Event 2, it was the overthinking process of trying to reach a perfection level that's unreachable. And that overthinking, it worked against me.
Yeah.
And you lose time that you ain't gonna get back. And I'm just not doing that anymore. So with that being said, everything that ended up on Diligence 2 felt like it was perfect together, because I started it in November of 2025, Dilla Estate and
Mom and
Mod Dukes and you know, everybody that contributed to the project and was a part of it. Once the word started to spread that this was happening, a lot of incredible people that respects and honors both of our legacies separately, but even more so together, it was almost like a desire and a need to want to be a part of it, because a lot of people never had the opportunity to work with Dilla, let alone meet Dilla.
You have Lil Wayne on this album, who, as far as I can tell, never really rapped on a Dilla beat before.
Never.
And then you have Common on this album, you know, D'Angelo, as I mentioned, also a late collaborator of Dilla from over the years. Was it important to you to curate that list of new people who should be part of the Dilla legacy and people who are already part of the Dilla legacy? Like, was that the idea?
No, I just focused on wanting to make great music. Mm-hmm. The timeless greats that are on the album that already has work history and relationship history with Dilla ended up on the songs because they contributed to the song and made it what it was supposed to be. But if it ain't right for this song or for this project, it's just not going to happen.
And tell me about these D'Angelo vocals. So were they on this Dilla beat already, or you were able to bring together different sessions from over the years?
I was gifted with something that they did that they didn't finish once the word started to spread about this project.
Yeah.
It's like people just started to make sure that I had some really special pieces and moments, and that was one of them. I didn't know that it existed because it was done 20-something years ago. They started something and it just never got finished. I loved the both of them, so I wanted to do it whatever justice that I could do it and continue to uphold the legacies of these brothers. You know, I just want to do my part in delivering in that way, not just for the culture, but for them and for all of us. You know what I'm saying?
How heavy is that emotional process for you? I mean, especially on a record like the one with D, you have two folks that are close collaborators of yours from the past who have passed on. Do you feel a heaviness, an emotional heaviness, when you're engaging with making music with the ghosts of these folks? Does that weigh on you in any way?
That part don't really got nothing to do with the song. You know what I'm saying? Like, that don't got nothing to do with the music. That got everything to do with the death being so final. And those two brothers, for me, you know, it was very, very, very long-term friendships. So, you know, I met D'Angelo before I met J Dilla. So it's like, you know, and I met the both of them through Q-Tip and Ali. So, you know, it's just challenging to not have them or not have Fife Dog and not have, you know, a lot of the people that you've shared a lot of time with over the years. When they're not here no more, it's going to always reoccur, that feeling of missing them and just wishing, or just even going back, harboring on the thoughts of some of the good, the bad, and the indifferent times.
When you were coming up as a teenager rapping and in your 20s and finding fame, there weren't rappers in their 50s still doing it at the level that you and your peers have been lucky enough to see. When you were looking at the forecast of your career and you're thinking, okay, I'm big in my 20s, you know, maybe I'll be big in my 30s. Like, what did you think your 40s and your 50s and your 60s looked like?
I didn't look that far. I also think, you know, the culture is young, you know what I'm saying? So you wasn't going to have that from the time that the culture was born. You know, this hip hop shit is about 52, 53 years old, probably tops at this point. So it's like, you know, a lot of us were either just born before the culture started, or was being born when it was starting, and we grew with the culture, and it grew with us. I think this is the first generation or first time frame in the culture where you're gonna see it lead the charge for it to continue to happen on a regular basis, because a lot of the generations behind us, or after us rather, they're not actually too far off from 50 years old themselves.
Right.
In the next 5 to 10 years.
Yep.
I don't put a timeline on greatness. You know, you continue to do it as long as you're amazing at it, you still love it, and you know how to monetize this shit the right way. And I think that's the most important part.
One thing that I love to see on the internet, and I feel like this comes up every couple months, there's a great video of you embracing a younger artist and essentially giving them their flowers. Usually it's the other way around. It's a younger artist going to an OG and saying, hey, you really, you did something for me, even if you don't know. You do the opposite. Can you tell me why it's important to you for you to look someone in the eye and say what you do is valuable?
I don't have no problem showing love because that's kind of how I was treated by the gods of the music when I was coming up, you know? So it was like to get on stage with leaders of the new school and you got Dayline in the building or you got, you know,
Tribe.
Cold Crush Brothers is in the building. Yeah,
Public Enemy.
Public Enemy is in the building. It's like these brothers came and they embraced us with grace and they made us understand, you know, that they seen some sort of like future in what we was doing that was promising. Like they didn't really just, you know, your shit is dope. Pleasure to meet you. Get out of here. It wasn't. So, you know, I'm a reciprocator of the energy. And when I feel like I'm receiving good energy, I give it. I love to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on. So I pay attention to shit and I'm inspired by shit that people wouldn't even expect.
Yeah, it goes beyond hip hop. There's video of you with Adele. You popped up recently at the Charlie Puth concert. What brought you to the Charlie Puth concert?
Well, Charlie Puth is an incredibly huge fan of hip hop.
Yeah. Sure.
You know what
sure
I'm saying? Like, and he knows hip hop. Like me and him had an extensive Dilla conversation. You sure know what I'm saying? So, you know, he just loves the culture. And he reached out to us to want us to come out with him because he was at the Garden and, you know, prime playoff time with the Knicks. And you know, we was fortunate enough to have our schedules aligned. So it was just something that was just a dope opportunity. I'm a fan of Charlie, too. So
there's a lot of cross-generational stuff with you because I feel like you're so major for people my age and even younger in terms of breaking open our expectation of what hip hop could look and sound like, right? I remember being a kid seeing your videos on BET or MTV and thinking like, I didn't know this was allowed, right? Whether it's the sound or the dress or the Hype Williams extravagance, the videos, you know, you have someone like Billie Eilish saying, I learned how to rap your Look At Me Now verse. You know, that was the first verse she could rap.
Look at me now, Busta Rhymes.
You can do the whole verse real quick.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
Stuff like that goes viral every year, right? A couple times a year. What do you think it is about what you were doing going all the way back to Scenario, but up through Wuha, you know, Put Your Hands, like, what was it about what you were doing there that you think has been able to transcend demographics and generations in that way?
The common denominator is the feel-good energy.
Mm.
And
the total packagedness.
Yeah, because it all coincides, you know? So you constantly are being given the same person and the same feeling in many different creative ways. Even down to the lyrics, like the lyrics, when I'm performing on a record, I make sure that I'm doing it in a way that's going to make people feel good. Even if, you know, we're talking our street shit, I must still display it in a way where it's going to entertain people from a feel good energy standpoint. And just being free with it. I don't limit where and how I'm going to share the music. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'll be on tour. We'll go on tour with me, Missy, Timbaland, Sierra.
Right, you guys did that recently.
Yeah.
Legends tour.
Then I'll go on a tour with 50 Cent and Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'll be on a tour from a while ago with David Bowie, Blue Man Group, and fucking Moby.
Wait, what tour was that?
How really? Did we miss that one?
Yeah.
What was backstage like at that tour?
It was calm.
Yeah.
It was Zen? Calm.
Compared to the 50
It was calm.
Tour.
It was calm because, you know, Moby is a reserve energy, and you know, David Bowie is super rock star and over the top on the stage, but he was just like
chill guy,
super cool. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Blue Man Group, you didn't really see them too often because I guess they were spending a lot of time getting
in paint,
yeah, prepping for each show.
They were in wardrobe and makeup.
But the dopest shit about that is to see that the audience that was there, and the fact that I was even considered to be a part of a lineup like that. It was another testament to the feel good energy that people get from Busta Rhymes. But I'm being seen in this way by the likes of greats on a David Bowie level. For me to be looked at in a way to where they would say, "All right, we need a Busta Rhymes on this lineup," It's like something about him that just transcends this the spectrum of shit beyond measure.
If we go back to the early to mid 90s, I think about the sort of duo of Scenario, obviously, and then the Flavor in Your Remix. And you do a very similar thing on both of those records, which is that you show up at the end and you sort of go, you kind of grab the energy and sort of like shake the song up. A song in both cases that already are like quite great. And then you go and you say, well, what if we amplified it to another level?
A grand finale.
Yeah. So you're there batting cleanup, basically. Like, to me, those two songs have a lot in common, but there's something a little different for me about Flavor in Your Remix, because Flavor in Your Remix to me was like all the different tribes coming together. You have the Bad Boy, you have Biggie and Craig Mack, you have LL coming in with that sort of classic, like, Walk with a Panther flow, you know, and then you have you coming from the Native Tongue universe into the Bad Boy universe. Was it unusual in the moment to have folks from all those different parts of the New York rap tradition coming into the same Break Fool on the same record, as it were?
It wasn't really about the crew that you came from. It was just about if you was dope enough to rip it down on this record. Who's going to bust ass when they get on this joint? Who's going to show up? You know what I'm saying? Who's going to handle their business when they pull up? And that's really what it was. That's what it became. It was like respectfully competing with each other.
Sure.
And, you know, just doing your part and delivering and making sure at the end of the day, nobody don't want to have that you the weakest link finger pointed at them.
Of course.
And what's the importance of going last on a song like that? And was it always clear that it would be you?
At that time, you know, it meant that you had the verse to bring it home and you had the best verse on the joint at that time, or you know, it's not that doesn't apply in the same way now.
No, now if you're last, you might be the worst because on streaming, people just want to skip
forward.
You know,
I don't think that the way people are wired anymore. Even if the record is a dope record, a lot of the time you ain't gonna hear this shit go to the end of the dope record,
right?
Even if it ain't a collab,
right?
A lot of people's focus nowadays, primarily when these collabs is happening, is they want to get their shit off first.
Yeah.
Not last.
Before the DJ cuts it off.
I was looking at the list of remixes that you did in the late 90s into the 2000s. Ja Rule, Holla Holla remix, even coming up to Swain, the ASAP Ferg Shaba remix, the All I Do Is Win remix. I did not even know there was a Tracy Lee The Theme remix.
Busta Rhymes coming in and busting you like my Antonio Andorra.
What's your mentality when you're going in the booth to do one of these songs, knowing that there might be 2, 3, 5 other rappers hoping to eat your lunch, basically? What was your mentality?
It didn't matter if it was one MC. You know, the goal is always to try to be the one that the general consensus across the board amongst your peers in the music game or the consumer, the general consensus, you always wanted it to turn out being that you stole the show or you owned the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And that's really the mentality that it was all the time, because we came from battling in the street. You know, it really wasn't no buzz that you could get from social media, and everything was word of mouth. So you had to prove yourself every time when you stepped outside, and there was no such thing as when you come out the crib and somebody call you out. Nah, I ain't battling today. That wasn't an option either. Once people knew you was an MC, if you ever had to deal with being called out, you had to answer it. That just being a part of the recreational side of what we was doing made it even that much more serious when it became about reputation and business and the way you had to protect the value of your brand.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So if you wasn't going to let yourself take an L in the street,
definitely
you
weren't
for
going
damn
to,
sure ain't taking no L on no record. It was good pressure.
Who's your best competitor?
I was just
going to
say, who pushed you the hardest?
Like, yeah, like who's the LeBron to your Steph or whatever? You know, who's like the friendly rival who brings that out of you the most, or unfriendly if it's like that?
I don't really have friendly rivals or unfriendly rivals because I don't rhyme with the same person regularly.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But I'm inspired by, like, you know, Q-Tip inspires me. J. Cole inspires me. Kendrick inspires me. Conway the Machine inspires me. Benny the Butcher. Rock Marciano inspires me.
Do you still write by hand?
No, I haven't written by hand in a long time. But I started to run into this issue where if I'm writing a 16, but I'm taking my time with it, because maybe the lines ain't coming as quickly. By the time I would get to like the 11th or the 12th bar, I might have forgot the way I meant to say the second bar. And the yeah. third bar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would frustrate the shit out of me because I'm like, damn, how did I say this? And I'm looking at the words, but I'm not remembering what the cadence or the flow pattern was intended for these words that I'm staring at. And now I got to fucking figure out a new way to say the same shit. When I initially wrote it, I had the perfect way to say it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I don't want to ever lose those moments. So as I think this shit, I sit right in front of that bitch and tell them, punch. Let's catch this. Mm-hmm. Let's catch that. It's like the deadliest catch, that TV show?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. About the boat out in Massachusetts.
And, you know, seafood mm-hmm. with the crabs yeah. and the mm-hmm. lobster and all of that.
Yep.
It's pretty much that is the process for me. It's like you throw your fishnet in the universe, and sometimes you catch a bunch of fucking lobster and crab mm-hmm. and shrimps. And sometimes you go out there and throw your shit in the universe and you don't catch nothing.
But it's interesting to me that you adapted with the new technology, because I feel like a lot of rappers of your generation, or even someone like an Eminem, you know, is still writing stuff out on the legal pad by hand.
There is no right or wrong way, though.
Totally. You putting out this album with these Dilla beats, like, that's something so homemade, right? The there's something so old school about it in this time when you can order up a Dilla beat on an AI prompt probably any time, you know, and a lot of people getting older, trying to stay with the times, they're more interested in making AI music than they are about digging back in the crates and rapping on 20, 25, 30-year-old beats. Is that intentional for you to put out something that harkens back at this moment when most people are looking forward?
I don't want to put out 20, 30-year-ago shit if it don't sound and feel like it's right now shit.
Right. It's not vintage for vintage sake.
Oh, a lot of people find comfort in old shit. You're quite striking in that you've never settled and said, this is where I get off the highway. Everything after this, I got nothing to do with, you know? It's not a lot of artists of your generation, I think, they're like, my best shit was in 2004, and thank you so much.
Nah, I get it, because those moments, everlasting impressions were made. So they definitely hold sacred spaces in your heart. You know what I'm saying? There's moments like that for me. But there's so much new shit that still makes me feel like how I felt when I first heard Rebel Without a Pause.
Yes, the rhythm, the rebel, without a pause, I'm lowering my level.
I'm just in that space. But the thing for me is the Dilla shit sounds even better than now shit.
Right. It still sounds modern.
It's beyond modern. It's in the future. Motherfuckers still don't know how to do and make the music feel like him. But what I'm saying is what Busta Rhymes is feeling creatively in today's day and time, and how I would enjoy sharing how I'm approaching my music today, which is why, you know, I don't overthink the music. From November to now, that's not overthinking the music. When I started to put out Extinction Level Event in 2020, that album started being worked on since 2009, once I completed Back on My Bullshit. Mm-hmm. That's 11 years.
Right.
So you regret taking that long?
Abso-fucking-lutely. There's just no sense in that.
Right.
Yeah. Fuck you thinking about for 11 years. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, it wasn't all the way about being critical. It was also circumstances too.
There's a lot going
on. I didn't
on.
Feel a lot of comfort in who I was putting the music in the hands of.
Mm, business wise.
Yeah. There were situations that I was in that I didn't want to stay in.
Right.
Those situations. So, you know, a lot of that factored in. But again, doing diligence too and doing it the right way and really, you know, making sure that every T was crossed and every I was dotted with the music, the business, the whole aesthetic, and making sure that the opportunity to give people the feeling that a lot of folks in this culture haven't gotten yet. Because many generations since Dilla passed. For a long time, I'm just like, yo, where's the feeling of this Dilla shit? And do they even know that this feeling exists?
Do you think you can reach a new audience? Do you think you can get young people in this glut of content, in this endless waterfall of music from their peers, from young artists? Like, can you get through to them? How do you get them to pay attention?
I'm not trying to get through to anybody. I'm trying to just make the dopest shit that I love. If it reaches you, that's a blessing. If it doesn't, hopefully it eventually does. And I think the younger generation is already super displaying the fact that they've been hungry for this feeling. That's why you got the Larizis. That's why you got Coast Contra. That's why you got Griselda. That's why you got, you know, Alchemist, Black Milk, Kendrick.
You see that as a hunger for...
I see the success that they're having on their levels, from the biggest level to the most successful on the underground level. And all of that is what was inspired by the shit that we loved.
Where do you see your influence? Whether it's musical, fashion, videos, like where do you, what was the last thing you saw where you said, ah, my DNA is there?
I'm never the one that feels like I need to say it. And I think that's where the reward is the greatest. But, you know, Ludacris has said to me many a times that, you know, the Busta Rhymes DNA is in his blood.
100%.
Missy Elliott says it. You know what I'm saying? Kendrick has said it, you know? Dolce has said it, you know?
Yeah.
And I love what they do, and I love who they are, and I love what they have created and taken from what the influence has been and made it their own. It's the same with me. Like, I took a lot of my shit from Cold Crush Brothers and Grandmaster Caz specifically. Rest in peace to the almighty JDL. You know, same thing with Chuck D. I took a lot of shit from Chuck. Like, we was taught a lot of amazing shit from Public Enemy.
Are we talking showmanship, lyricism?
All of it.
Talk to me about showmanship, because I think that is something that helped establish what the Busta Rhymes proposition was in the 90s, for sure. And all the artists you just named as people who have said to you, like, I took Busta Rhymes, those are the showmen and the showwomen of modern hip-hop. Who are you drawing from, inspiration-wise, to know how to be not just a great rapper, but a great visual presence?
You know, we pulled a lot from the names that I mentioned.
Yeah.
But even outside of that, you know, there was other genres of music that was just crazy to me when I saw the live show.
Your Jamaican heritage.
Yeah, dancehall stuff.
Yeah. The dancehall shit, obviously. Yeah, you know, everybody knows that story. Mm-hmm. But this shit like Parliament Funkadelic, mm-hmm. right? And then you would have shit like Motley Crue, mm-hmm. and Black Sabbath. Mm-hmm. And Queen.
Sure.
Prince and Michael Jackson and fucking Earth, Wind, and Fire, yo. When it come to the dancehall shit, it was Bob Marley was like God sent. It had this dude named Ika Mouse. He was crazy to me, too. His style and his charisma and the way his whole sound and feel was, it was like some shit that was like, this motherfucker is ill to me, yo.
Good album covers, too.
Yeah. Shabba, you know, Major Mackerel and Admiral Bailey and Peter Papa Son, and just taking a bit and a piece and an ingredient from all of these different things is what made me feel like it's too much amazing shit you could be doing on the stage to just be walking around acting like you too cool to show.
And yet, many do.
Still yeah, today. Do. Yeah. Maybe more than ever.
That shit was weird. It was always weird to me that you get blessed with this opportunity to go up there and fucking tear some shit down, but your ego won't even let you. Sometimes I watch artists and I'm like, I know that you feel like you could, like you want to give more.
And you think it's ego that's blocking them?
I think a lot of that, because motherfuckers feel like, and to me, I think a lot of the times, motherfuckers is a, the discomfort of not looking cool in a snapshot, mm-hmm. or not looking cool in a way that could compromise the credibility that you feel you working so hard to protect. Especially when you one of them dudes that want to be out here talking a lot of that street shit. You got to kind of always remember to make it match in every dynamic of when you present yourself.
You also were one of the first rappers in my memory in the 90s who started making clothes. Not only were you dressing in this, you know, highly coordinated, extravagant silhouettes, luxurious fabrics, but I remember when it was announced back then, you know, Bushi was the name of the line.
Yeah.
You know, I was actually Googling around the other day. You can still find some Bushi pieces there on eBay if you want to go grab them. But tell me about that moment, because right now we take for granted. It's like, oh, Travis Scott, of course, he's got 50 sneakers with Nike and he's got a clothing line. You know, ASAP Rocky got a clothing line. Everything post Kanye is like obvious. Pharrell running Louis Vuitton, it's obvious. It wasn't so obvious in 1997 or 1998 when you were chipping away at that. Talk to me about wanting to make that part of your portfolio as well.
It's all a part of the cultural aesthetic when it comes to hip hop and just the way we did things in our community as Black people. It was always cool to have the first thing. The beauty of discovery was the shit, and still is to this day, right? Mm-hmm. People always like to be the one to say that they're the first one to step out in a particular colorway of sneakers, mm-hmm. right? Or whatever that designer line is. You want to be the first one to have whatever the thing is from that designer line that you can say on the record, nobody ain't see this piece before me. Mm-hmm. But when you was able to find a piece that a motherfucker could never find, mm-hmm. not only did you have it first, but now you're the only one that has been able to ever come across this item.
One of none.
One of none. Before we actually got into a position where we could showcase the shit we was doing because we got the deal we was on, we was able to be in these videos and we could really showcase what we was creating and designing for ourselves. A couple times I ran into situations where I spent some good money on a fit, and I go to a party or something, and another motherfucker will be in there with the shit on. So I never really dug that. And probably after two or three times at the most of going through that, I just was like, I ain't letting this happen no more. It ended up being more cost effective to move like that, too.
Mm. You saved money.
Saved a lot of money.
So much of what you're talking about, whether it's comfort on stage or the fashion, has to do with how you feel in your own body. You've been open over the years about your health journey. There's an amazing men's health cover with you from a couple years back where you talk about your ups and downs. As you're entering middle age, like, how do you feel physically, and what has that path been like for you to get to a place where, as you say, you're happy and healthy in a way that maybe you weren't when you were at the height of your fame?
I feel like I'm at a higher point of my career fame-wise because, you know, the Botanical Gardens is starting to grow.
Sure.
Getting Hollywood stars and Global Icon Awards and fucking Lifetime Achievement Awards and just the abundance of flowers that I've been receiving between last year and this year. And movies are starting to pick up again.
Naked Gun, you're in the, Naked, in yeah. the remake.
Yep. Yeah, but even more so than that,
yep.
like there's new movies coming.
Sure.
That I just completed shooting it towards the end of last year. That's just too much amazing shit now that wasn't happening then. But I get what you were saying as far as, like, you know, the younger years and the newness and the freshness and the excitement of what we was doing at that time and the bigness of what we was doing with $2 million videos and shooting movies back then and going multiple platinum sales. And the thing for me that I feel great about is because, you know, I love the weight loss. I love being in shape. I love the fact that the more that we've been able to master the shit that we do, the more dangerous we've become. If we was at our height to you when we was learning as we go along, and I haven't lost none of that energy, and I've mastered what you loved as I was learning when I was going along, but we mastered it now and know how to apply that same energy and on a level of experience now in a way that's crazier than it was then.
So you feel at a peak right now because the mental is matching the physical, is matching the artistic, is matching the legacy. Like, you feel like everything is clicking at a higher level now?
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens is you evolve. You know, the
goal. Not for everyone.
Yeah, plenty of people, not so much.
1 second.
Oh, sure.
How much longer is this interview?
About 20 minutes, maybe.
We got to shorten that. Or I need a break right now. It's almost 5, and I got to make some shit happen before the wire transfer deadline.
Oh, no.
Because I got to get some people some money to do what they need to do to promote my damn record that just dropped at 3 o'clock. So can I just get a second to call my accountant?
Yeah.
Just
call your accountant.
Yeah, you got to call the accountant.
Yeah,
you got to call the accountant.
The accountant waits for no interview.
You got to motherfucking send this money to... All of the folks that the dots got to connect with.
If someone's got to get paid, someone's got to get paid.
Okay, we are back. Joe's back. Busta Rhymes is back. A podcast first. A live wire transfer sent mid-episode. Salute to that person. Congratulations on getting paid on time.
Let's finish. I am going through hell right now. Home because stretch. I can't. You know, like when you the day your shit drops, it's a lot you got to do.
Yeah.
You feeling stressed?
I'm not able to do none of it because I'm here.
Well, this is part of the promotion.
I completely understand. I'm excited about it. I got to get to the other side of the work though too. So
what are the other things?
They busting my ass right now.
What do they want from you?
It's a lot of shit. Yeah. It ain't even worth getting into right now. We're gonna be here longer.
Let's finish, let's hit the home stretch.
The last thing. You have been on obviously hundreds of songs. Thousands, maybe. What is the art of talking your way onto someone else's record? Not just having them come on yours and not just getting a phone call that says we need a bust to 16, but to go into someone else's studio that didn't even know that you were next door, and then you'd be like, I should be on this. I want to be on this. How can I be on this? Tell me the art of that.
There really isn't an art to it. It's just being comfortable enough to go in somebody's session. And if you like something, you just solicit in yourself. Because a lot of the times, you're not on everyone's mind. It's like, fuck that. It's almost like you're not going in there to negotiate it. You know what I'm saying? Once motherfuckers see that I'm interested, they always want to at least hear what I'm bring to the table, because people know that I'm always going to deliver something special at least 99.9% of the time. There's been moments where that has worked against me.
Mm.
You know, you steal the show and then the motherfucker knows that because you might have got the better moment in that song, it's almost like the song becomes your song.
Mm. What was the last time that happened?
There's a record that didn't come out because the manager reached out. They didn't ask me to be on the song.
Okay.
I solicited myself.
All right.
So what ended up happening was I pay attention to the conversations. And, you know, if I don't hear my name coming up enough in the conversation, I pay attention to who they think is or who they're saying is.
Mm-hmm.
And I just research who out of those names has a record out that's crazy right now. Mm-hmm. And I'll jump on the record and put a verse on it and I'll send it.
You'll just unprompted.
I'll send it to the management team, or I'll reach out to the artist myself. The communication will start one way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe after a few days or a couple weeks, the call comes back and goes, yo, Bus, what up, bro? Like, can't steal a boy shine like that, man.
Too much aura.
Thanks, but no thanks.
But it's interesting because this song ain't come out. So whoever heard it in the immediate circle,
mm-hmm.
or wherever they chose to play it,
mm-hmm.
it must have didn't pan out.
You going to name names or you're not going to name names?
Nah.
You're not going to embarrass anybody?
Nah. I don't want to embarrass anyone.
I will say that to me, the lesson of this is here you are, 30 plus years into your career, still advocating for yourself, still saying, I have something to offer, I can add value to this, And even if you're not, like you said, you're not on everyone's mind. I think people think that that is the end point. But you're saying, I may not be on your mind, but what if I was? What if I can present something to you? I think a lot of artists are maybe too prideful to do that, to advocate for themselves.
Believe it or not, a lot of artists do, though, solicit themselves and advocate for themselves.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of motherfuckers do it because it's also a tool that motherfuckers use to keep they self hot. The only difference is they don't necessarily go through the proper protocol. They'll just rhyme on your shit and leak it.
Yes. Plenty of that.
You know what I'm saying?
And then sometimes it takes off and they have to put it out anyway.
Sometimes it does. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Let's hit some questions in the lightning round. Busta Rhymes, we got the Popcast deck here, 52 cards, allegedly, in this deck. Every card corresponds to a pre-written question on the Popcast questionnaire.
I feel like people have walked off with cards.
Yeah, we think so people what? Might have stolen some cards.
Yeah, I feel like
cards.
We might be a 49 right now.
Yeah,
like,
well, we don't, you know, who can
who
say?
Knows? Who can say?
Pluck a card at random, show the camera what you got, and John will ask you what comes up. What do we got?
Ten of clubs. Okay. When is the last time that something did not go your way career-wise? And how did you cope with it?
The 11-year process to record Extinction Level Event 2.
Mm-hmm.
I did not like the time lost in making that project. And I didn't like the situations that were being presented to me when I was trying to figure out where I was going to release that project. But I just didn't like what the business was that was being presented to me for this project and what I wanted this project to do and who was on it with Kendrick and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and Rick Ross and Mary J. Blige and Mariah and Anderson .Paak and it was just this Rakim, like
Rakim, yeah.
Like this album was, it was supposed to be handled with a certain level of care. It was my first part two sequel in my whole career, and I definitely didn't want it to be treated any less of a priority the way the first Extinction Level Event was treated. That time probably was the time that was one of the most challenging because My patience was tested probably in the most extreme fashion in my whole career.
And how was that like? How did you cope with that? How did you wake up every day and say, is this another day where these jokers are going to keep testing my patience? And then how do I keep being creative, productive, emotionally present?
Nothing stops you from being creative. That's the therapeutic part. Just always being able to work, go in a studio and keep cooking. And I just wanted the right support system that I knew was going to care for that particular project because of how much time and work and patience and money, because that whole shit was out of my pocket.
Yeah.
So, because it was just like, yo, went through 11 years of fucking saying no to this and saying no to that, and saying no to this, and then the dopest shit finally presents itself because it came out on October 30th, 2020. And then everything is closed.
Right.
This is fucking crazy.
This wasn't meant to be.
It wasn't meant to be in the way that an ideal dream come true situation for that album would have been preferred to happen.
All right, pull another card. We'll do three in all.
Cool. Eight of clubs. Oh.
Eight of spades.
Spades, yeah.
Eight of spades.
Spades.
Okay. What always makes you laugh?
A funny motherfucking joke.
Okay.
What kind of joke do you think is funny?
No, that's it.
No, I want to know. You like
that
a long wind
answer.
Up? You like potty humor? What are we talking about? You like wordplay?
There's no category for the shit. If the shit is funny, it's gonna make you laugh. Motherfuckers say shit that ain't funny, but they still consider it a joke to them. And that don't make me laugh. If it shit ain't funny, it ain't funny, man.
Many such cases. Right. Incredible. Next card.
You cracked the question.
That's incredible. That was beautiful. All right, Ace of Clubs. Actually, good question, because you've been doing this for so many years. What are you good at? besides what you do for a living?
I'm serious when it comes to making some incredible breakfast.
Now we're talking.
You know what I'm saying?
All right, like, what do you got?
Chef it up.
Yeah, what do you, what's a brunch spread at the Busta Rhymes?
You know, it's the regular breakfast shit. You know what I'm saying? It's eggs, pancakes, waffles, shit like that, because I had to do it for myself. I had to do it for my kids, you know, because I'm not a big cook. I'm not the illest with, you know, like you looking for steaks and shit like that. That ain't
what
I'm doing.
You're not on the grill, but you could do breakfast.
Nah. We on the grill for burgers and shit like that. But like, if you're talking about cooking a real steak for dinner and, you know, potatoes and vegetables and all of that type of shit, I'll leave that to the queen to do. I'll leave that to the queen or to the matriarch of the family, which is Ma Dukes. That's the ultimate royal empress. I'll let them be the specialist in this space.
But you can do breakfast.
I'm pretty nice. I'm pretty dangerous when it comes to that breakfast shit.
All right. Speaking of food.
Yeah.
Busta Rhymes. Every episode of podcast ends with a snack. You have the distinct honor of being the first person to say, no, thank you. I don't like snacks.
There's scrambled eggs, potato chips over there. If you're so into breakfast.
You turned down our snack. But John and I are going to eat a snack.
Scrambled egg, potato chips.
Because it's this is tradition, so John and I are going to eat a snack. What kind of snack do you think we should eat?
I don't know. What you got over there?
All right, we're eating scrambled eggs, potato chips.
I'm just saying, we'll eat it.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you can absolutely do your thing.
We intend to.
I refuse to engage.
Why? Can you explain why?
I just don't trust shit that's in those bags pre-made by any companies.
You know, no packaged food.
When I was younger, all day. I just ain't a fan of that shit now. Like, I've had a bag of chips probably in the last year or two.
You had one bag of chips.
Probably. Some undetectable shit might be crawling around in the bag, bro.
Okay. I mean, nervous. Like a bug.
Whatever the thing may be.
You don't even want to smell these. You don't even want to smell these.
Come on, give me the bag.
You won't smell these.
Nah, I'm cool.
All right, here's what we're working. We're working with scrambled eggs, potato chips.
I got them from the Naruto Japanese spot.
With the Naruto bag.
Yeah, the Naruto bag.
You like any anime? You an anime guy?
I'm definitely a fan of that.
This is a Naruto snack.
Two things you love, anime and breakfast.
Choji approved.
And yet still will not engage. That's okay. We're going to have it anyway.
I do not like a scrambled egg chip in general. Yes, I have had a scrambled egg chip before.
As have I.
I never heard of this brand. I never heard of that shit.
This is kind of good, though.
Yeah.
It's buttery.
It is buttery.
It's a little sweet. It's less eggy.
That's what I'm saying. It feels dessert-like. It feels dessert-like. It doesn't feel savory. Mm-hmm. It feels dessert-like, mm-hmm. which is like sweet dessert.
Okay.
Interesting.
All right. We got potato, palm oil, compound seasoning. Flavoring agent.
It definitely got some MSG.
Look, I'm not saying it's good for you. I'm just saying it's good for the show.
This is not the health portion of the show. I do want to say, it doesn't advertise as sweet. Like, you wouldn't look at the bag and think that's a sweet chip, mm-hmm. but it is actually a sweet chip.
Mm-hmm.
It's a seven and a half.
We'll rank it out of 10.
It's a 7.5.
It's a solid 7.5.
It's a solid 7.5.
It's way better than I thought it was going to be.
It doesn't have the crunch that I really love. It's not quite as crispy as I would like, but it is sweet. It does have, maybe it's anime, maybe there's a brightness to the anime. I don't know.
Not tempting at all?
Incredible.
Yeah, I'm so past this part of this.
All right, that's it.
The snack shit is crazy.
Good thing it's
crazy.
The end.
The egg, potato, chip. Really swung it out the ballpark for me to not want to try it.
Okay, well, we appreciate you being game to watch us try the egg potato chip. Busta Rhymes, thank you for being on Popcast.
Thank you for having me, man.
Privilege to have you here.
Real dope. Real dope experience.
Every episode of Popcast is at nytimes.com/popcast. We are on YouTube, of course. Like and subscribe, youtube.com/popcast. Instagram, TikTok, you know where to find us.